Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust, so you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 4th of August 2009 and the time is 21:19. If I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
Okay. Hi Kate, my name's Jez Collins. My date of birth is 10th of the 9th, 1969 and I'm from Birmingham.
And how are you today?
I'm good. It's like 40-odd minutes to go, so looking forward to getting up there, really.
Brilliant. What was it that first motivated you to apply to be part of One Another?
I think probably it was Anthony Gormley. I've been aware of his work since... I first came across his work in 1995 in Sydney, Australia. We were travelling, and he had the Terracotta Army, and I didn't know much about him then. And then we came back to Birmingham a year later, and in Birmingham, there's a statue called the Iron Man, which is not particularly well known in terms of Gormley's work, which is really strange, but it was one of his, I imagine, one of his first public pieces of work, and it's at an angle, and it's in the centre of Birmingham, and it rusts, and it's to celebrate the city and the region's heritage. So that really cemented the place, in terms of his work, and I've followed it ever since. So the idea of being able to be part of sort of One Another with the fourth plinth with his work is really intriguing, and I was hoping for a little terracotta man or woman at the end of it, but I don't think I'm going to get that.
Fabulous. So when you found out that you had got a place,
yeah,
and you were going on the fourth plinth,
yeah,
how did that feel?
Good. How did it feel? It was good. I was surprised, and I think it's probably a reflection on today's society. I think the first thing I did was rather than tell me my wife or me mama tweeted it, so I think that was probably the first thing I did. It's great to be selected. 2,400 people. In the schemes, is tiny in the country, so a feeling of pleased sort of elation, and then as it's come nearer to the date, thinking, God, what am I going to do on there? And then that's been an interesting journey in itself, really, I suppose.
Yeah. How did you make that decision?
I haven't. I'm still sort of thinking about it now. I've not prepared anything, and I had up until Friday had a pretty clear idea what I was going to do, and then my wife just mentioned something, and I thought, right, okay, you're actually right on that, and that changed the whole dynamic of it again. So it's still, as we approach, not fully fomented at all.
No.
any
little inklings that you could share with us?
Yeah. Sorry. I think. I'll say something on the plinth as well, but for me, the idea of the plinth was it was about a snapshot of the country at a given time or a given point in time, and there's been a lot of people up there, and this is not a criticism of anyone, but there's been a lot of charity things and people golf or whatever, and I was going to do something around Polaroid film. I was going to take one picture a minute and just date it and chuck it out, and that was about art and about the immediacy of art and all that sort of gubbins. And my wife said, well, what's been interesting is that actually people seem to be advertising rather than reflecting. And I thought, yeah, you're dead right, actually. I haven't seen anyone just sitting and reflecting upon themselves or talking about their hopes and fears. So I think that's what I'm going to do tonight.
You're going to, what, internally?
No, I'm going to sit right at the back where it's much lower, thank goodness, where the cameras are. And I'm going to talk to the camera, or the cameras. I'm going to be mic'd up. And I think I'm going to just reflect. I'm 40 in a month or so time. And I'm going to reflect on the last 20-odd, 30-odd years. And I think I'm going to talk about my mum a bit. And she'll slap me around the head when she watches it, but I think I'm going to talk about my mum and my family, and just I'm going to get something down on film for my kids, so in years to come they can come and watch it and they'll have some sort of record.
Yeah. When you say you're going to get something on film, what do you mean?
Well, it's going to be streamed, it'll be streamed, and I'll be able to rip that back at work and keep that, or we can come down. I'm really pleased to see tonight the Wellcome Trust are going to actually complete an oral history, and they're going to license under the Creative Commons license, which is absolutely fantastic. But there'll be some sort of permanent record that we'll be able to access. So I'll just, you know, like I say, I think I'll use that this hour to just talk about whatever comes into my head, but around that yeah. those feelings.
Yeah. Lovely.
It might not be.
I think it sounds lovely. And you just said you're about to turn 40.
Alright.
How are you feeling about that?
Me? Right. Age is nothing, is it? Really? It's, you know, it's what it is. It's only a number. So you know, I've had a few mates, I suppose, go through the sort of midlife crisis and do strange things, but it doesn't bother me. It's just, you know, you just carry on. So I've got a couple of kids and a good wife and good friends. So age is just a number.
Mm. And what's important to you in your life at the moment now?
Family. You know, I think that's probably obvious. I think everyone would probably say that. There are things I'd like to do and achieve. I think I've just come out of a tough couple of years in terms of a business. I'd like to put that behind me and move forward with the family. Not, I want my kids really to experience the world and see things that's, you know, that is available to them much easier than it would have been when I was younger. So I suppose you know, the immediacy is just to have a good time, but just to bring my kids up right, really, and to make sure that they're things like culture and you know, music's culture, but things like that, and travelling and experiencing different cultures and people and races, that they're open to that. I think that's important.
Yeah. How long have you been married?
I've been married now, what year is it, 99? I've been married, when did we get married? 97, 12 years.
Yeah.
So, 16th of August, 97, so 12 years in next week after.
Oh.
So, yeah. Actually, 12 years, bloody hell.
And what's married life like?
It's getting married is just so the state can see you more, really, for your pension and stuff. It does, a piece of paper doesn't mean anything. I think we did it. We'd been travelling. I think we wanted to come back and just have a party. So, you know, we got married, and but that the marriage part doesn't make any difference. You either love someone, you don't, like I say, and for the state or whoever to ratify that doesn't mean, you know, doesn't make it any better or any worse. So it's the partner you're with, I suppose, more than the status.
And who's your partner?
Jenny, birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday, Jen. So we're staying at my sister's tonight, and we're going to take the kids out for something to eat. Probably got to bring Deezy or something tomorrow and have a bit of tapas with the kids and then drive back to Brum.
And how old are your kids?
Sonny is five next week, and Scout 2.5.
Mm.
So youngish, but growing up quickly.
Fabulous names.
Yeah, yeah.
You chose those.
Yeah, we did. Well, yeah, Sonny was a joint while we were struggling, and then, you know, Sonny's, the connotation with Sonny is all the bad people in the world, and it's Sonny Liston and Sonny Corleone and Sonny Bono and all those people who were fantastic artists and characters, but weren't particularly nice people. But also there was some jazz musicians, Sonny Boy Williamson, etc. So that was that. Scout is, I had a bar called Atticus. I love the book To Kill a Mockingbird. And my name's Jeremy, and no one calls me, but a shortener of that is Jem. From that, the bar was called Atticus. And I sort of foisted Scout on my wife as she gave birth. So she's still not 100% sure, but Scout comes from To Kill a Mockingbird. And there's also a songwriter called Scout Niblett, who's very good as well. So not Demi Moore. We found out after that Demi Moore's got a kid called Scout. And we're like, shit, but there you go, it's too late.
Is music something that you're quite passionate about?
Yeah, very. I'll probably talk about it a bit tonight in terms of its cultural value. This is popular music. And I'll probably talk about something I'm doing an oral history project in Birmingham called the Birmingham Music Archive, collecting people's memories and histories and reminiscences and building an archive of that, but rather than being a totalitarian archive, i.e. that, you know, we build an archive of the things that we know, we're trying to engender people to make and build that archive and construct that archive. So music's been really key all my life. Something my mum introduced me to, and my dad's, and my sister's now a music journalist, and I work at a university with in and around music, so very important.
Mm. Would you like to say a little bit more about your work?
Yeah, it's what do we do? I'm sort of in a precarious situation with, I work at Birmingham City University, and I'm currently on short-term contracts. I'm hoping that that might change. So I do a bit of lecturing around popular music and the music industry. And I'm the originator of an archive, Birmingham Music Archive, birminghammusicarchive.co.uk, that the university partnership with. And then the university works within, I work within the School of Media, and we look at cultural theory around media, so that's journalism, photography, radio, music, cultural industries, cultural policies, etc. And then we apply for research funding, so we do core teaching. And the team that we're working are very keen into getting our knowledge that we have into the wider communities, whether that's in industry or business for small, medium enterprises in the creative industries, or whether it's you know, just in general in terms of knowledge transfer to the wider public. So it's a really interesting post. I've only just been doing that for a while, because I had a bar that just collapsed. So I'm just going through all that liquidation nightmare, banks chasing me for money I haven't gotten, all that sort of horribleness. So to work with these people has been fantastic. It's been really good, and I think we're doing some really important work, actually, you know, in terms of knowledge exchange and knowledge transfer around online music technologies.
Yeah. What experiences have you had with your own oral history archive that you've been doing the music archive? How have you found that? And I bet you've met some really interesting people.
Yeah, I mean, although working it seems like ages, it's fairly new in terms of its, we've only just launched, it's an online repository. So we're looking at how we can capture and build and construct archives online. I think we'd like to move to a physical exhibition in due course. But the press picked up on it. We didn't do, I haven't put a press release out, and the press picked up on it, and have been inundated with people who have just got fabulous, both in terms of their oral and written histories, and sharing those written histories with memorabilia and reminiscences they've got, whether it's posters or whether it's ticket stubs, whether it's clothes. We've had people who've been making film, have got old film footage, donating it, and the response has been completely overwhelming in terms of this is something that we really need in Birmingham. And Birmingham's got a reputation, really, I suppose, as being, for popular music, it doesn't push its weight as Manchester or Liverpool or London or Bristol does. And there are cultural and economic and social benefits for the city to that. So the archives around civic pride, and I think that's rang true with a lot of people, and we're finding a lot of people wanting to get involved. So I need to push that forward. I need to find funding for it. Artichoke, if you're listening, welcome, Trust, if you're interested. The website doesn't particularly work. It works to a point. We've got it to a point. But now, like I say, with the material we're getting, we need to push that forward.
Mm. And what about the lecturing work that you do and the research? Is it mostly community music kind of work that you're lecturing on?
No, it's cultural theory that we don't actually do production in the School of Media, although that might change. So we, you know, students don't come to us to actually make music, but to get an understanding of the business and how business is constructed, the music business, how it's constructed and how it's changed, how it's changing, and how as young entrepreneurs they can once we aim to give them the skills that once they leave university they can go into that work. So we don't actually look at and say, you know, go and work for Warner's or EMI. It's about keeping them within the city and saying, you could, you know, the industry's changed to such an extent that now, you know, you don't need to be signed to a label, you don't need the infrastructure of a label, you have, you know, emergent technologies and opportunities that you can use to bring new business models. So that's what we're doing, the lecturing. In terms of our outreach, in terms of our knowledge transfer, it's very much business based. In terms of we're currently working with 29 radio and music organisations, and they range from Giles Peterson's Brownswood label in London to Fat Northern and Unconvention in Manchester, to Tipshaw, who put on a fabulous a festival called Supersonic in Birmingham. So we have a completely wide range of organisations, care, radio, who work in developing countries, and we look at radio as a social tool for communication. So it's a really widespread, and it's all about, it's not so much business support, but it's about looking at their business and being able to work with them and exchange the knowledge we know about these issues for them. They can use it or not, but for them to be able to take time to reflect and then perhaps use those ideas and that knowledge to impact upon their businesses. Mm. So it's really interesting, and you go to work and listen to music and talk music all day, so what's not to like, really?
Yeah. Would you like to say a little bit about how the industry's changed recently, just for future generations?
Because yeah, absolutely.
In a particular time.
Yeah, the industry... Well, the industry hasn't changed, and that's the trouble with the industry, because it's refusing to accept, although it knows that it's changing, but it's refusing to accept, and it's what the industry is doing is trying to control and keep hold of their bottom line, which is money, really, and they're not looking at music as a cultural endeavour, which is now due to, like say, technologies in terms of the internet. In terms of social media like Twitter and Facebook and MySpace, the proliferation and the access to music that we've had, it's just incredible. You know, I've been a music buyer for all my life, but the amount of music I'm now able to listen to at home from any corner of the world is just phenomenal. I think the industry are looking at it from the way of protectionism and from keeping hold of their economic power, which is understandable, absolutely fine. There's an economic aspect to music, we understand that, but if you think about copyright, 90% of recorded music is not available for the public domain or in the public domain, so we get to 4 or 5 organizations keep hold of 90% of the music, and you have to wonder why, because it's not economically viable to them. Fine, give it back to the people who wrote it or made it or published it. Put it out into the public domain. Let people, as all art and culture is, to take it and use it and make new meaning from it. And I think until the industry recognises that and gets to grips with that, it will continue to struggle. And of course, the terminology that it uses now, that everyone, if there was a case in America last week of a young kid, 22, 23 year old, I think he was, downloading music, wasn't selling it, wasn't looking to make profit. And the recorded industry in America fined him £22,000. And he's not a teenager, but he's 21, 22, no way of paying that money. And they are trying to bully and harass people who they know can't have no answer to them. They have got no answer to the power, the economic power, and the legal rights. So the terminology about downloading, about piracy and illegality, and it's all that. It's all business orientated rather than culture orientated. And I think what I'm interested in, what we hope future generations will be able to have, is access to that. And we'll have access for students and academics and for non-profit organisations who want to actually promote music as culture rather than just as an economic necessity. Well, not necessity, as an economic force that it is now.
Mm. And is this something that the students you're teaching believe in as well?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say they believe in it. It's one area of debate. These are young people who have got their own opinions. So we don't teach, or I certainly don't teach, a stance of it has to be this, has to be that. We engender discussion and debate, and we hopefully give a fair-sided view of that. Of course, there are still people in universities all across the country who'll be in bands or be running labels or who will be promoters, who that model will still work. They'll still want to take that model and normally migrate to London to make their fortune. But even London, we know that's not particularly true. So I think it's not just in terms of my students, but I think across, there's a change within education and within cultural theory that's beginning to understand music as different than just the economic means, and that is, like I say, the cultural. Because if the music industry collapsed tomorrow, people would still be making music. There's just no question about that. So we have to think about, like I say, new ways about how, the businesses have to think about new ways how they can monetize that. But for practitioners and for academics, For government agencies, they have to start thinking about new models to open up and include and embrace the new culture that we're in. If they do that, then there's money to be made for people. And again, there's no question about that, but there's also a space for the consumer, for us to for our voices to be heard.
Can I ask a little bit about you?
Yeah, you can.
You work in the music industry.
Sort of, yeah, very tenuously.
Yeah, yeah. What other aspects of your life would you say kind of come together to make you who you are?
Politics, I think, and that stems from the parents. I've just started. Well, we're a big Irish family. I mean, I was born in Birmingham, but my mum comes from a big Irish family, and we're very close. And although it's a big, widespread family now, we all get together, you know, a few times a year, and have a good crack. And I think that sense of family and looking out for each other, coupled with politics, I think, and coupled with culture, you know, it's not just music. I used to be, before the kids came along, me and my wife used to go to the film quite a lot. You know, we go to galleries still. We love travelling, we love exploring, we like to trying different cultures, food, drink, you know. So I think that it's a bit of a mesh, really. It's music's very central, but music helped give me my politics. But I think that idea of that sense of having a very solid base with my family has driven me really for the last 20 odd years 30 odd years.
And what aspect of politics in particular, more like personal politics, do you mean?
Well, I used to be very, very, very active in the trade union movement, really active in the trade union movement. And we, in Birmingham, we used to work for the city council, and we had our branch was sort of 18,000-19,000 strong, so it was huge. And I was an assistant branch secretary, so it was a huge responsibility. You know, I remember poll tax rights down here and being in Welling for the BNP and stuff. So it comes from a socialist background, I suppose. Left of centre politics, but always voted Labour. Always been a staunch Labour voter, and I'll continue to that. And that's a discussion me and my wife have now. She's erring towards Liberal Democrats, and it's like, for me, however poorly that or however badly the Labour Party have let down, for me, the working class and their core supporters, it's coming to the point where if we don't start voting, whatever we think of them, then the Tories are getting in. And I think if the Tories get in, then it really is bad. And we've seen the rise of the BNP again in certainly the North West, Manchester and Hull, Manchester was just bizarre. So, you know, I think the Labour Party should be shameful about, you know, creating a vacuum where the far right have had an opportunity to gain votes. So I'd say my politics is sort of socialist. Whether that's in practice, I'm not sure. They come from a long line of trade unionism work. No longer active, you know. You change, you move on, and sometimes I feel a bit guilt about that. I'm not as active as I'd be, but there's things like I've just found out today that it looks like there's going to be a BNP march in Birmingham on Saturday, so I'll make sure I'm down there to counter that act, because I think it's really important that, you know. And for me, it goes back to my kids as well. Now, really, that I want them to grow up in a society where, you know, gay, lesbian, black, white, Irish, disabled, whatever, you know, all the cliches. But I want them to feel that, you know, whoever they are and whoever their friends are, that they're valued, and there's a place for everyone to be hippy dippy, I suppose. But you know, that's just one thing I can install in my children. It'd be that to have a rounded view. You don't have to like everyone, but you have to make sure that that everyone's treated as equally as possible.
When you worked for the trade unions, were there any kind of moments of protest or any kind of situations where you felt things were really kind of hotting up or really difficult?
Yeah, I think there were. I think, you know, there's people in this country, they you know, talk about, oh, you know, the revolution's never going to happen, it's just all a waste of time. And I think we've come close to, not to all out insurrection, you know, in terms of there's been times, certainly with the miners' strike 25 years ago this year, that pitched battle, it was a pitched battle between police and miners, and that brought in people, certainly women, and the support groups that they struck up. So they politicised a lot of women, I think, around that time. It politicised a lot of communities. It certainly highlighted some of the nasty aspects of the police and how they propped up the state. And I think I can't even remember the year now, the poll tax is 89, I think, 1989. When we got here, it really was closed. I mean, it went off for a good few hours. And there was a big movement in terms of the SWP, the Marxist Party, class war. There was a huge surge in squats, and it created what the Tories never, well, they probably did realise, but never said. It created a huge class of lawbreakers, and that was just people who were saying, "We're not paying the poll tax because it's just my mum." There were, you know, elderly people, there were young people who wouldn't dream of breaking the law, but they broke the law because they could see it was unjust. And I think that they've never recovered from that. I think there is now a sizable proportion of society who will not willfully break the law, but who are probably more vocal. Mm. And it just, you know, at that certain time, it was really, I think, you know, if the movement as a whole could have pushed on a bit, then there could have been a big change. And it wouldn't have been an overthrow of the state. The Queen wouldn't have been on a bail in Buckingham Palace. But it could have been a change for the better. And I think we lost that. And I think if you look at the peace movement now, it's a completely different kettle of fish, where you had some 250,000, probably more on that peace march. But it was fairly ordered, and the police tactics are obviously a lot more sophisticated. So they pick out and they head off people they would deem to cause trouble. But then, you know, you had the G20 thing the other week. So there are always little pockets. It never reached that stage, I think, in Eastern Europe. And that would have been the time around 89, 90, where Britain could have perhaps followed on and looked to those countries in terms of what had happened there. But there's definitely been, and there's been loads of other times, there's been loads of things around the troops out movement and all that stuff. But I don't think we've ever been particularly close to a complete overthrow. But there's been times where it's, like I say again, like the poll tax definitely radicalised a huge swathe of the people who wouldn't have dreamed about it.
Mm. Could you say a little bit about your parents? You said they influenced your...
Well, I mean, one of my earliest recollections is standing in a place called Piccadilly Arcade in Birmingham, outside a record shop called Stops, with my mum and my dad queuing for Bob Dylan tickets. And I must have been, I could only have been three or four, I suppose. And it's a memory that sort of sticks in my head. And I remember I had this like rainbow jumper, I had long curly blonde hair, and my mum and dad were definitely sort of hippie types, I suppose. And they were really good people. They split up when I was about eight, so my dad left, and I had a sister, Hattie, who was four. So I think from that moment on, I've been a much closer to my mum. You know, I love my dad, and I still see my dad, and he's got a new partner, and I've got another great brother. But my mum's always had a bit of rough luck with men, with my dad, and then she met someone else, and he ended up committing suicide, and she's never really found someone else to settle down. So probably what I'm going to talk about tonight is this idea about, you know, one of my fears is my mum being on her own, blah blah blah, but. That they gave me a real sense, even though they were apart, both of them gave me a real sense of not what's right and wrong, but encouraged me to, and my sisters, encouraged me to take a more rounded view and not always just to see one side, but to see both sides and try to articulate. But was very much based on you know, my mum was very much involved in the women's unit. Women's movement around Grimm and Conneman, and there was in the early 70s a women's playgroup sprung up all over the country, and she was quite prominent in that in Birmingham. Very political, taking me and my sister minor strikes, so it sort of encouraged that really, and then and has installed a sense of again, I don't like, right and wrong is not right, is it? But you know, has always been there and has really strove to better herself or to educate herself, not better in terms of material wealth, but intellectually. And I think she's always encouraged her children to do that. And again, another one I'd say tonight is probably art. I didn't understand that when I was younger, and I went the other way. I just completely rebelled and left home and stuff. So she's a very strong woman, my mum, very strong woman, and she's done a lot for us, I suppose.
What does she do for a living?
She should be bloody retiring, but I lost all her money in my pub venture. So she's still hanging on, working, lecturing at Josiah Mason, which is a sixth form college in Birmingham. But she's 62 and she should be, you know, enjoying the, you know, putting her feet up or doing whatever she wants to do, off cycling somewhere.
What's her subject?
Her subject changes, and she is currently doing English literature, I think, but she might be doing film next year. But if you ever listen to this, Mum, I'm sorry, I always forget what she does. But it's English lit, I think, or English. Might be even cultural studies, but I'm not sure about that.
And what's your mum's name?
Bernadette. Bernadette Christina Ford Collins.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to say?
No, I've got to think about it, say all this again now, haven't I? And we've only done, 20 minutes? Oh, good. So I've got another 40 minutes after that to film. No, look, it's just good to be here. Hopefully I'll do the hour and say a few words. And like I say, it's all going to get in my head now, because I've just probably said it in a different, completely different random order. So that's the thing I was going to ask before I get up there. But thank you for your time.